And so I was with a group of older women faculty, most of us Jewish, and some community people, non-faculty, but people who'd been associated with the college for a long time. So we decided to stand between our students and the riot police. And I was recording my students being arrested. And I also said to the riot police twice, "These are my students, leave them alone, they're not criminals."
I'd say we had about 200 people on campus, mostly in union shirts, and we were prepared to make a ring around the students if the police came, and to force the police to arrest faculty members before going into the encampment and arresting our students as a way of fighting for their rights to a freedom of speech and assembly. And the students, I thought, were brave and clear-eyed. They saw what they could win. They saw the win. They took the win.
Personally, I think once they get a taste of this kind of repression, it might become a part of how they approach this, any kind of protests, any kind of dissent in the future.
That was Annalise Ehrlich, a professor at Dartmouth College, Todd Wolfson, a professor at Rutgers, and Avedita Majumdar, a professor at John Jay College in the City University of New York system. All AAUP members who've been involved with the ongoing protests on campus. And that's the topic for this episode of AAUP Presents, the podcast of the American Association of University Professors. I'm the host, Mariah Quinn, AAUP's digital organizer. From getting arrested to leveraging union power to protect students' right to protest, this episode's guests tell us how things look at the campus level and how they're organizing against the militarized, violent crackdowns that threaten academic freedom, free speech, and the future of higher ed as a common good. In addition to Annalise, Todd, and Avedita, AAUP President Irene Mulvey closes out the show with some words about the disturbing trends in these protests and the crucial role of education. We'll start with my interview with Annalise Ehrlich of Dartmouth, who was arrested on May 1st at a protest at Dartmouth. In a video widely circulated on social media, Ehrlich is shown being thrown down to the ground by police in riot gear as she sought to protect students from arrest. Ehrlich was one of 90 people arrested at Dartmouth that night. She is a professor of history and a former chair of Jewish studies at Dartmouth College. She was the founding co-president of the Dartmouth AAUP chapter. So let's talk about what happened Wednesday, May 1st at Dartmouth College, where you've taught for more than 30 years. There was a protest in solidarity with the Palestinian people and other campus protests across the country. It was called Labor for Liberation. From the time the protests and the encampment started until the police came in and then the arrest started was just hours. So things unfolded very rapidly. Can you tell us about the rally up to the point where the arrest started?
The rally began as a labor rally. It was May 1st, and graduate students and the undergraduate student workers union had declared a strike against the college. So it began with a rally to support the strikers and to try to raise some money for the strike fund. And it was co-organized with students and faculty and staff for justice in Palestine. Where things started to get tricky as far as the college is concerned was when the tents went up. So they went up at about 6:30. We were called, those of us at the rally were called, if we so desired, you know, to make a circle protectively around the tents. People did. And what started to happen later is that as the riot police showed up, I think around 8:45, other students streamed out from their dorm rooms. And I'm not sure how the word was passed because interestingly, the cameras that usually monitor the green were turned off at that moment, and armored vehicles and militarized police arrived. They were from the New Hampshire State SWAT and riot control teams. So they were outsiders to our campus. They know nothing about our campus culture, and they were, it seems like, ordered to clear the green at all costs, and the cost was high.
And who called that, the state troopers and riot police in?
The president insists that she only asked for help from the Hanover Police Department, which is what's usually called in if there's a protest. But, and I'm not sure why they would have been called in anyway, because we you know, the students may have been in violation of campus policy, but they certainly were not doing anything illegal, aggressive, or really that unusual for a college campus protest. She claims Hanover called the SWAT team and the riot police. Those of us who've been here a long time do not believe for one second that that kind of militarized force would come on campus without the permission of the Dartmouth College president. Also, it's a private campus, so I'm not sure how they could even come in without the permission of the president.
And yeah, and you've said, and I've read that this was a peaceful protest.
Completely peaceful. I really want to emphasize that. And visibly and audibly interdenominational. Mm-hmm. Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and Buddhist faith leaders there, you know, announcing themselves as that.
And so after the police appeared and riot police, as you've described, what did you do at that point?
There were many faculty trying to protect the students in the encampment, and there were many faculty and postdocs and staff in the group that we were in, which was a group of students who started to flood onto the green to the right of the encampment as a way of supporting, and people were chanting. And so I was with a group of older women faculty, most of us Jewish, and some community people, non-faculty, but people who'd been associated with the college for a long time, including one 82-year-old activist who was pushed and had her hand hurt. So we decided to stand between our students and the riot police. And I was recording my students being arrested. And I also said to the riot police twice, "These are my students, leave them alone, they're not criminals." And that's when the crackdown began, and I was violently assaulted. I was body slammed from behind by these riot police in armor, intending to knock me down. They knocked me off my feet. I almost felt like I was flying a little bit, and I landed at the feet of the protesters. They took my phone in the course of that, got up. I asked for my phone. That's me on the video that many people said, you know, makes clear that I deserved what I got because I was pointing at a police officer. To which my favorite response was, they should have had fast food workers. There are retail workers who get pointed at every day and handle it a lot better. So anyway, that made them enraged. And they picked me up under both arms, slammed me down on the ground, dragged me on my face, across the grass, kneeled on my back, took three officers. Three officers were holding me down. I still have a bruise on my leg in the form of a hand. They then zip tied me so tight that I was crying in pain. And I said, you know, "You're hurting me. Please loosen them. I'm not asking you to let me go." And then I was jammed into Dartmouth College vans, which had the logo covered up, to be taken to a series of local jails with other, with students, faculty and staff who were also arrested. These guys were serious. I believe the mandate on the state of New Hampshire website for these two groups of state police are active shooters and hostage taking situations. So that's who was called in for a group of 10 students, supported by many others, but 10 students, you know, violating college policy, sitting in tents cross-legged or on their knees looking out on what was happening.
How are you doing?
I'm hurting. My shoulder hurts. My hands still hurt where I was dragged. And the bruise is starting to heal, but I have nerve damage in that wrist. A couple of sprained ligaments. The reason I can list all this is because I had a physical therapist come over a couple of days ago to look at my body and try to catalog what was injured. Emotionally, it's hard too, though. I'm definitely having intrusive traumatic images come into my head when I pass the green, which I'm legally not allowed to step on now for at risk of being arrested.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. Bail. So after your arrest, you were barred from campus as a condition of your bail, and that was later updated to just include certain buildings, including the president's residence and the green. Have you been back on campus?
We had a couple of good classes, but yeah, I went back onto campus yesterday and taught both of my classes, but we're all tired and traumatized. And unfortunately, the building that I teach in is on one of the streets that I'm barred from, where the president's house is. And so I just, you know, I put on my sunglasses and I ran into the building. It was just so ridiculous. Mm-hmm.
So afterwards, the history department, you're in the history department, released a letter saying, "We reject the administration's claims asserted in President Baylock's message to the community that the arrests were necessary to ensure safety and peace on campus. Instead, the administration summoned police forces from outside the campus, a move aimed at intimidating and criminalizing student protesters. The letter asks that the charges be dropped against students, among other demands, and that the administration make it publicly known that academic freedom includes the right to peacefully protest and to express support for Palestinian rights." Has there been any response to that?
No, we had a general meeting of faculty yesterday with the president. The senior administration, over our objections, insisted that there was no physical space on campus where we could meet, and that we had to do it by Zoom. And then Dartmouth College, which just is working on a $90 million renovation of a perfectly fine performing arts center, insisted they, for cost purposes, they had a 500 person cap on their Zoom meetings. They wouldn't get the license for 1,000. And so there were many angry members of the faculty who were shut out of that meeting. At the meeting, reiterated our demands, drop all the charges, senior administration apologize for the harm and trauma that they've caused, revised their protest policies to be more in line with constitutional protections on freedom of speech and assembly, get rid of the Palestine exception for free speech, and promise that riot police will never again be called onto our campus. There's been spin about how supportive they're being of all of us, including myself and my colleague, Chris McEvitt, the other faculty person who was arrested and harmed physically, but no response to those demands.
And so in terms of what happened last week, obviously it affected academic freedom, free speech, and the right to protest on campus in Dartmouth and elsewhere. How are you looking at this as a historian and someone who obviously experienced this very physically about what this means for higher ed going forward at Dartmouth and elsewhere?
I was watching an interview this morning with a young encampment protester from the University of Virginia, and she had had her tent destroyed by riot police and all of her belongings taken, so that she currently has nothing. And it was a really upsetting interview because she pointed out what we all know, which is that that was the very same campus where white supremacist protesters marched in 2017, chanting, "Jews will not replace us." And they were not subject to that kind of violence or police protest. Indeed, they were able to keep going, for quite some time with their Unite the Right gathering. I think we're in a dangerous situation. There was reporting from The Guardian and the BBC that the people who attacked the encampment protesters at UCLA had been seen in video of Trump rallies. There were reports that, and also in Proud Boys rallies, there were reports that protesters outside the Columbia University gates in New York who were saying offensive and anti-Semitic things included some Proud Boys, including possibly Gavin McGinnis, the founder of the Proud Boys. So I just wish that the narrative about these protesters and the whole discussion of anti-Semitism on campus would take a broader lens and incorporate, the fact that this is part of the right's long campaign to take over higher education. And I think it's part and parcel of the K-12 book bans, and the criminalization of teaching, from kindergarten through 12th grade. I think we're in a very dangerous situation. And what's particularly frightening for a Jewish lifelong Democrat is the way in which, I see the Democratic Party and sitting Democratic congressmen come to Columbia's campus and support what happened to their students, where you had students who, according to colleagues, and it was just confirmed on Democracy Now!, were kept in solitary confinement without food or water, not allowed some other students for 16 hours, not allowed to call their parents. We are in a very dangerous situation. And I'm really glad to be on an AAUP podcast. I think that professors and members who have been at various campuses that have been so attacked need to start talking to each other, and we need a national coordination in our response, because this is a really rapid downhill slide to fascism. I'm old. I've been teaching for 34 years, and I've never seen anything remotely like this. The willingness to hurt people, the willingness to hurt me, the willingness to stick a you know, a police club in the ribs of an 82-year-old, the willingness to beat students. I saw one student from UCLA, you know, wiping the blood off his face, you know, in an interview. We are in scary times, and I'm really grateful to be part of AAUP, and I hope that we can have a concerted effort to work on these issues and respond to them.
And what's next for you at Dartmouth in terms of organizing and moving forward with what you're doing?
Well, as I said, we met with the president yesterday in this Zoom call with 500 members of the faculty. I think we're going to try to organize one that doesn't include senior administration and also continue to push our demands, which I think I laid out for you earlier. And, you know, many people yesterday, including myself, finished their remarks by saying no confidence. So I suspect that like Columbia, we may be headed toward a no confidence vote. I fear that like Columbia, the Board of Trustees will just support the president anyway. There is some support for her among our colleagues, which is really devastating to me personally, very hurtful, because it means my colleagues are willing to support my being beaten and arrested for doing my job and trying to protect my students and trying to protect free speech on campus. So, you know, we're going to keep going. I applaud the student courage today in trying to gather yet again on a space we're not yet banned from. I hope that the video that went viral of me being beaten so badly and all of the work of colleagues across the country, my colleagues at WashU, my colleagues at Emory, this morning colleagues at McGill are standing with the students. I hope that all of this begins to change the narrative of these students as, what did CNN call them? Dana Bash called them the Nazi youth groups camps in the 1930s. I mean, it's obscene and insane. And meanwhile, you know, people who supported the protesters on January 6th who have genuine ties to neo-Nazi groups, they have become the defenders against anti-Semitism. It's horrifying. We have to keep calling it out.
Is there anything you want to add that we didn't touch on?
I want to keep pushing back on the anti-Semitism narrative. It's what I get asked in every single interview I've done since this happened. Mm-hmm. And I want to say that the anti-Semitism is not, as I've seen it, is not coming from the students. And I guess as a social movement scholar, I would say there are always people who have more extreme views in any movement. There are always agents provocateur, and I think there are some of that in this case, who are there to make the student movement look bad or any movement look bad. And I just ask people to, especially our membership, to just observe carefully. And if you're on a campus with an encampment that has managed to stay and most of them have been displaced, you know, go down and talk to the students. I want to say our last president, who I disagreed with on most issues, handled this so much better. You know, he had students occupy his office and he talked to them. That's what a president should do, right? They're our students. We should be talking to them. We should be teaching them. This also is really important to me. I was interviewed by someone who asked me, you know, what was supposed to happen, you know, in the Columbia occupation, we saw, you know, scrawled graffiti in the building that said power comes from a barrel of a gun. And I said, you don't teach them that violence is wrong by, you know, bringing violence onto campus and beating people up. You teach them that violence is wrong by talking to them. So all these discussions of negotiation, our senior leadership, Columbia, kept saying, well, we tried to negotiate with the students and they were unreasonable. And the idea that then it's okay to violently assault them and arrest them and level charges against them and keep them in solitary confinement away from their parents. The idea that that justifies that is obscene. And I hope that faculty across the country will push back. And I also want to shout out to my colleagues, particularly at WashU and Emory, who were beaten and assaulted by police far worse than I have been, and applaud their courage.
Next up, I spoke to Todd Wolfson, who is president of Rutgers AAUP AFT Academic Worker Union. Rutgers has proved the exception to the wave of arrests and crackdowns. The encampment there ended after a negotiated dialogue between the students and the administration. Faculty members were on hand throughout to support and protect the students, and as Wolfson and I discuss, the relationship between the students, the union, and the wider community likely helped strengthen the ability of the protesters to hold the line against the administration. Wolfson is an associate professor of journalism and media studies at Rutgers.
So we're going to talk about Rutgers. Unlike other protests, which have ended in very militarized responses and mass arrest, students came to a negotiated solution with the administration to bring an end to the encampment at the Rutgers New Brunswick campus. What role did the faculty and unions play in the events as they played out last week? There was a large number of faculty on hand preparing to protect students as the threat of arrest loomed, from what I've read. So could you just talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So my union, Rutgers AUPAFT, as well as the adjunct union, we both have called for a ceasefire. We did that, both of us, back in November, but we were not able to create this sort of democratic process that what would have allowed us to completely support the demands the students were making in the encampments. I do think we need to think that through and think about a democratic process for having that conversation. And so our approach was that because we can't fully co-sign the encampment, what we can do is demand that they have the right to freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and political protest without political repression, which is what we've been seeing across the country. And so the students led this, absolutely. The faculty and I think even some staff, but largely faculty, all sorts of faculty, full-time, tenured, non-tenured, and adjunct, all came out and agreed to be what we called faculty defenders. We invited membership to be a part of this. We had about, I think, over 200 people sign up, and we were careful. Only tenured faculty were going to be defenders that would actually get arrested, because we thought we had the best ability to protect them against any sort of response from management. And then there were about another 100. So maybe 100 people signed up to get arrested, another 100 signed up to be observers. And we were in dialogue with the encampment. Members who are leaders of my union were supporting the students as the students developed demands during the encampment and negotiated with the administration. But the union as an organization was not involved in that. And on Thursday, which is the day where much of this played out, in the morning, the students had a protest. It was the first day of finals, and the university canceled those finals. And it felt like they used that as pretext to end the encampment. And so they called for they said the encampment had to be over by noon, and then it was 2, and then it was 4. And in that process, and starting the day before, the students were in negotiations with the administration about their demands. And so we called members to campus on Thursday. I'd say we had about 200 people on campus, mostly in union shirts. And we were prepared to make a ring around the students if the police came, and to force the police to arrest faculty members before going into the encampment and arresting our students as a way of fighting for their rights to a freedom of speech and assembly. So we had about 200 people out there. Meanwhile, the students were negotiating with the administration. When it looked like the administration was trying to strong arm the students into caving on their demands because of threat of sweeping through and making mass arrests, we moved to reach out to the governor and the U.S. senators in New Jersey, Senator Booker in particular, as well as the president of the university. And we strongly pressed them not to do that and to take a more thoughtful approach. I do not know what sort of impact this had. And then, you know, we were there when the students at 4 p.m. or so got a response from the administration and they had 11 demands, and I think about 8 or 9 of them they made significant progress on. And so we stepped back out of the encampment, and the students had a democratic process where they voted. It took about 45 minutes, whether to close the encampment or to stay in the encampment and fight to win more and see what the police next steps were with the police. Ultimately, the students, I would say by a large majority, voted to support the demands, the negotiated demands. And so the police did not come, and the students then took down the encampment of their own accord. And so the union itself and the faculty connected to the union had a very particular role, which is we didn't co-sign the demands, we didn't co-sign the encampment itself, but we fought to protect it.
And do you view what happened as a success in terms of how things unfolded and the union's role and the faculty's role in helping protect students and the right to assemble and free speech and so forth?
Yeah, I think it was a step forward. It's not perfect. The things the students won, some of them are processes, like the divestment is not a given. The students will have to work with a committee on the Board of Governors, which governs Rutgers, that a committee on investments to talk about divestment and to try to win a strategy around divestment. And so that's a process, right? It's an important process. The university has never opened itself up to a democratic process around their finances. And so the students made a huge step forward on that and on many other demands, but they didn't win everything. And so I think it's a victory. I think that the administration, which my union has not always seen eye with, in fact, we went on a strike last year around, around things. I was happy to see them come to this with an open approach. And the students, I thought, were brave and clear-eyed. They saw what they could win. They saw the win. They took the win. They were courageous. And so I think it was a step forward. I think there's much more work to be done, but it was a serious step forward. And it was a step forward because of the bravery and vision of our students.
We've talked in the past about the Rutgers wall-to-wall organizing model and kind of relationships between various groups and unions. Do you think that helped play into this more concerted response that you were able to take and the support that you were able to offer? And does this serve to help develop that model going forward as a model of strength and unity across various sectors?
Yeah, I think absolutely. People involved in the strike were involved in the encampment, learned from the strike, moved forward with the encampment, and became strong and are becoming really strong organizers and leaders. While the faculty unions were the ones that came out the most en masse, there was a lot of professional staff out there during the encampment and certainly during the hour, 4 o'clock hour, that were prepared to either get arrested or be observers. Rutgers is spread out across the state. There's a couple other unions that have leadership in other parts of the state that reached out and said that they were fully in support. So I think the alliance that has emerged between all the unions on campus and the Coalition of Rutgers Unions in alliance with students had a role to play here. Relationships have been established. Leadership was developed. I think the other thing actually is the university knows how well organized the campus is, both the employees, the faculty, and the staff, as well as the students. And they know that they have to take a much more careful approach. So we did hear directly, not directly from to me, but directly to some of our members who are closer to the administration, that the fact that faculty were out there and prepared to get arrested had an impact on how the administration approached this. So yes, I think it's a great step forward for our collective work and should be a step towards more collective work moving forward.
The Rutgers AUPAFT released a statement about the encampment, and in it you said, it is necessary to defend the rights of our members and students to speak, assemble, and protest, especially in the face of threats and repression. This is a pretty dangerous time for higher ed across the country with attacks on academic freedom, free speech, the right to protest, and so forth. How are you seeing what's happening in higher ed at this moment, and how are you organizing in response to it?
I think you're right. It's a very dangerous moment, and higher ed seems to be under attack. And this particular kind of acute attack on higher ed comes on the heels of 50 and 60 years of divestment. And so often we've seen presidents being forced to come down to Washington, D.C. to account for the way they've approached Islamophobia and anti-Semitism on our campus. And I think that those presidents largely have had trouble responding because they don't have a core vision about what the university is meant to be, because neoliberalism has hollowed out our universities over such a long period that our university presidents don't fully understand the role. I think are less clear about the role of the university. And the only people who seem clear about the role of the university on the national stage are fascists or extremely right-wing Republicans. And what they want to do is control what we say, control what we teach, control what we learn. And the struggle and crisis in Gaza is another example of that. So I think there's these twin crises. One is the divestment of our institutions and the sort of outcomes we've had. And the other is a much more recent right-wing attack on our campuses. So I think I believe strongly that the only way forward is to build a strong and powerful movement of higher ed workers, largely unionized, but also advocacy chapters and AUP and other workers that collectively stand up and one, put forward a counter vision of higher ed. I mean, higher ed was one of the most respected sectors in this country not that long ago. It's the bedrock of democracy, social mobility, innovation, and progress. And we need to fight to reestablish those principles and those values. And I think that really it's going to be incumbent on labor and students to come together to fight for that. So one of the outcomes of the Rutgers encampment is that our president is being called to Washington, D.C. on May 23rd to appear in front of the Education and Workforce Committee. And I think he's not alone. He's also being called with the UCLA president and the Northwestern president. So now it's incumbent on us to organize ourselves, all the unions and students on Rutgers campus, aligned with the UCLA campus and Northwestern campus, to build a unified response to that moment, both with our Congress people and then also in DC. And that's, I think, a crystallization of the bigger strategy we have to have, which is we need to organize across boundaries and build our power as higher ed workers with students to respond to the threats in front of us.
And given that when the Columbia president was called before that committee, she named the names of faculty, how are you thinking about how the Rutgers president is going to approach this and how are you organizing?
So we just reached out to the unions on UCLA's campus and we're going to start a conversation with them. The Education and Workforce Committee had written a letter to President Holloway, our president, and named some of my members. And we will vigorously defend their academic freedom and right to speak. And my members have been unfairly impugned by a very thoughtless committee leadership on the Republican side that we think don't understand the role of the university and also don't understand anti-Semitism. They do not. I'm a Jewish faculty member, and I feel like the people who are speaking about anti-Semitism are completely incorrect about what they're saying and are trying to curtail my members' right to freedom of speech and academic freedom. And so we will vigorously defend our membership. And I had every expectation that President Holloway will not do what the Columbia president did, which is put our members on blast and attempt to go after them. And if they do, the union will step in and step up and fight to defend them against the president of the university. But I do not think he'll do that. So at one level, we have to protect our membership from these incursions and from the president of the university or from the U.S. Congress. And then beyond that, we have to organize a response. We need to figure out how we can put pressure on our congresspeople. Next week, we are meeting with U.S. Congressman Donald Norcross, who is the only New Jersey member on the Education Workforce Committee. And we're going to make it very clear what we think needs to happen at that hearing. We will reach out to our friends in California and Chicago and Illinois to see if we can collectively meet with all the congresspeople from our three states that are going to be on that committee to make sure they all know how we feel and they support it. And then we might have to organize ourselves into D.C. I don't know. But we're definitely going to have to figure out how to respond to this.
Is there anything else you wanted to add that we didn't touch on?
I will say this. It's going to take all of us to figure this out. It's going to take higher ed workers, faculty, grad workers, postdocs, counselors, librarians, staff, professional staff, custodial staff, and it's going to take students and their parents to stand up and demand a different understanding of higher education. That's the only way forward. And the more we box ourselves in to these silos, the less we're going to have an ability to respond to the threats in front of us.
Finally, I sat down with Niveditha Majumdar, who is a professor of English at John Jay College in the City University of New York system. She sits on the National Council of the AAUP and is co-chair of her faculty union chapter at John Jay. Niveditha and I talked about how the recent protests at CUNY were treated differently than previous protests and her hopes for how students could lead a transformative struggle. Okay, so we're going to talk about CCNY and the CUNY system. On Tuesday, April 30th, CCNY campus police and later the NYPD arrested 173 people on the CCNY campus. Arrests were also made at Columbia the same day. Can you tell me about the encampment and the protests leading up to April 30th?
So, you know, when the repression started happening at Columbia and we saw this beautiful eruption of the protests all over the country. At the same time, CUNY was on spring break And some of us joked that the administration would not have been happier about the timing. But as it happened, even those students were on break on April 25th. The CUNY Gaza Solidarity Encampment that started at CCNY. And as we've seen in most other places with these encampments, it was very peaceful, very disciplined, very joyous, I would say. There was like food, water, medicine, and there were signs asking participants to check with organizers before speaking to press, you know, those kind of things, not to escalate a situation. And I would also say that it was always open to the general public. So even though it was on campus, people were welcome, supporters were welcome. And public safety, the college public safety officers were prevented from going in. So that was, you know, broadly that gives you a sense of what the encampment was like.
So on April 30th, obviously things changed and the police came in. Could you talk a little bit about what happened?
Sure. So like I said, CUNY was on spring break and school was restarting on May 1st. So there was some expectation that they would try to remove the encampments, and there were some notices, but nobody had expected what actually happened. So by 11 p.m. on April 30th, NYPD officers, and from the reports that we have, there were like hundreds of them in riot gear. They surrounded the campus around where the encampments were placed. And what we have also learned is there were members of the NYPD Strategic Response Group, which is dedicated to counterterrorism. And they basically locked down and barricaded all streets in a 2-block radius. And reporters were not allowed. I mean, we think there might have been a few from before, like before the barricading happened. But once it happened, no one was allowed. And then what ensued, you know, with the arrests, the treatment was like particularly brutal. There was pepper spray at like close quarters, bodies slamming up and down. We have reports of students and faculty with broken ribs, ankles, broken teeth, chemical burns, concussions, bruisings all over the place. One of our members was hospitalized with 3 broken ribs. Once people were taken in, they were detained for more than 36 hours for some people, which is in violation of the 24-hour rule. Some of our members and students are facing felony charges. And so I just want to say that, you know, this is in clear contrast with what some of us have had experience with in the city with civil disobedience protests. I mean, I've myself, you know, been jailed a couple of times for union protests, and it has been nothing like this. Nothing, not doesn't come close. In fact, the police were respectful. Everything was done by the book. So this was, you know, there was clearly signs that there were instructions from above of how this needed to be treated. So looks like the brutality was pretty deliberate and coordinated.
So your union, the Professional Staff Congress of CUNY, condemned, quote, in the strongest possible terms, the militarized policing of campuses that is taking place across the country and in New York City. Mm-hmm. What will the PSC do to support students and members? What did they do during the protests and in the aftermath as this continues to unfold and develop? And obviously people are dealing with these pretty serious charges.
Yes, I know. So PSC has been, you know, pretty active in issuing public statements throughout. And of course, the union's own resources have been available to all members if there were like disciplinary charges where we could be, you know, where we can directly intervene. Our president, James Davis, has also contacted the chancellor and asking them to intervene with the police and make sure that the district attorney drop charges against CUNY students and employees, and also refrain from taking disciplinary action towards students and members who participated in the CCNY encampment. I should say also that a couple of months ago, we also passed a ceasefire resolution. And, our members have been on the front line with students throughout, first for teach-ins and now with protests and arrests and all of this. And I see that level of support, that it would continue.
So in a May 1st statement, the CCNY president, Vince Boudreau, said, "I want to be clear that since the beginning of this protest, City College never once attempted or threatened to dismantle the encampment, nor in any way infringed upon the protest activities." And that clearly doesn't seem to be the case based on what we've seen transpire from April 30th on. What are your thoughts on how CCNY and CUNY as a whole have responded to the protests? And can you talk about it in terms of how you see it affecting free speech and academic freedom and the right to protest on campus?
The entire response has been pretty terrible, not just CCNY, but CUNY-wide. Right after October 7th, we saw administrative statements, both from the chancellor and university presidents, immediately, and of course, justifiably condemning the Hamas actions, but then expecting that there would be, an Israeli offensive and therefore lead to protests, etc. They were prepared for that. And those statements already, they were weaponizing the charges of anti-Semitism. And these were issued almost in every college. So that they were laying out the groundwork right from the beginning. Giving you one example, I believe it was towards the end of October, there was a peaceful protest taking place outside Brooklyn College, led by students. There were also faculty members. A New York City council member, a Republican council member, stood there the entire time flashing a gun just to intimidate. And while there were all these statements by administration about student safety, they did nothing about it. And even the next day, no statements were made condemning that kind of action. And of course, we have seen what has been happening countrywide. There have been, disciplining and firing of adjuncts. I personally deal with it as chapter chair. We always are receiving emails, especially from adjuncts, because they are most vulnerable about some kind of, something they said on social media or something. And because of that, they're getting disciplined and in some cases being let go. And the crackdown on April 30th was consistent with this whole approach. And your question about how it is affecting free speech, it is, has had a completely chilling effect. And while, some of it is, I believe, issue-based, because we did not see anything like this, say with the BLM protests, the recent BLM protests. The administration, in fact, if anything, was extremely supportive for the most part. I mean, there are certain expressions that they did not like, but there was night and day difference between the administrative approach to these two like recent protests. So in some ways, it's issue specific what's happening right now. But personally, I think once they get a taste of this kind of repression, it might become a part of how they approach this, any kind of protests, any kind of dissent in the future. So I think we have to be very, very aware of this, and you know, organizing has to be focused on fighting against this. So it is a disturbing moment, what is happening, and could very well have repercussions in the future.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so building on that, you know, given the rising trends towards political interference, militarized crackdowns, how are you thinking about that organizing to protect academic freedom, free speech, and so forth, both from your personal perspective as a faculty member, but also from your role as a leader in the academic labor movement?
Yeah, it's a great question. What we have right now is a climate of coercion, intimidation, and fear everywhere. And these college boards, these college presidents, they themselves are, you know, under pressure from their boards, their senators, governors, State Department investigations. All of this is happening. And this is happening across the board, everywhere. But I just want to highlight that public institutions are especially vulnerable because, to give you an example, in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul sent this memo to CUNY and SUNY demanding a quote-unquote swift disciplinary action against students violating university's code of conduct. And what does that even mean? I mean, you know, if there is a university code of conduct, there, of course, would be some kind of repercussion. But for the governor to send that kind of memo is, of course, a kind of a covert threat that unless they see the kind of, you know, actions they want, the funding will be withdrawn or reduced. There is always an underlying funding threat. So which means that, you know, unlike, say, the Harvard president, my president, even if they wanted to protect free speech, simply do not have that luxury because they are afraid of, you know, losing funding, and these institutions are not doing very well. So this, you know, it produces a very, very difficult atmosphere in which, you know, we are operating and will continue to operate. And of course, we saw the congressional hearings. It's just, you know, it's neo-McCarthyism, what we are seeing right now. What do we do? How do we, you know, come out of this? I think, you know, the idea of academic freedom, which is often kind of seen as, you know, a sort of an esoteric concept for inhabitants of the ivory tower, that has to end. I think our faculty organizing has to be broader. So the value of academic freedom as the fount of dissent, that has to be appreciated by the wider public. And that can only happen with organizing that connects us to students, to broader communities. I think the nature of organizing has to change. And I mean, you know, as troubling as these times are, I would like to believe it's also hopeful because students are maturing as well. They are seeing firsthand what administrations are capable of. And in the past, some of these, you know, movements, they were leaning on administrations to do the right thing. I think they know better now. They know the repression that these administrations are capable of. And so I think there is a possibility here of, you know, genuine deepening and expanding of the kind of political sensibility that is necessary for a transformative struggle. I would like to remain cautiously optimistic that that would happen.
We'll close out the show with a few words from AAUP President Irene Mulvey, who has strongly condemned the crackdowns. Here's Irene.
Look, free speech and freedom of assembly are fundamental freedoms in our country. When students are exercising the right of free speech on a college campus and it leads to conflict and disagreement, the way to move forward is through education, period, full stop. This means debate, inquiry, understanding other people's points of view, analyzing arguments, understanding why your words may hurt someone, and realizing that even the most deeply held beliefs must stand up to scrutiny. That's what we do in our classrooms and on our campuses. What we saw instead was law enforcement, heavily armed and in riot gear, called in essentially immediately to crack down with violence on demonstrations that had begun as largely peaceful and in outdoor areas. So immediately suppressing speech and silencing voices on a college campus, that is disproportionate to say the least and wrong in so many ways. And it's not hard to see the police crackdowns on the student protests as part of the broader efforts we've been seeing. Higher education needs independence, and our institutions need autonomy because we provide a crucial check and balance in a democracy. Once the government controls what happens on our campuses and in our classrooms, we have taken a very dangerous leap toward authoritarianism, and that should concern everyone.
Thanks to Irene, Nivedita, Todd, and Annalise for joining me on the podcast today. If you want more on the issue of political interference in higher education, check out episode 4 of this season, released on May 3rd, where professors Jennifer Ruth and Isaac Kamola talk about the history and escalation of this current wave of political interference and crackdowns. As ever, there are a lot of resources and statements on the protests and about political interference on our website at aaup.org. Subscribe and rate us on your preferred platforms to help us reach even more people. I'm the host, Mariah Quinn. Thanks for listening to AAUP Presents.